This is Tom Shrewsbury with Reflections for the Covenant Network. While we usually speak about the saints and holy people, with an occasional trip to other events concerning the faith, I thought today it might be interesting to touch on some of the places connected directly with the saints and holy people who have played a major role in the development of the faith. We might in a way consider these places as relics of the faith, although they certainly would not meet the exact definition of relics. But for the most part, these are places we can visit. These are things we can see, and some certainly are part of the foundation of our faith. And if we're there, well, we might feel a little closer to heaven, and maybe they'll help us never take our faith for granted. Perhaps one that I find so fascinating and impressive would be the steps on which Christ had to climb on his way to Pontius Pilate's apartment after the scourging, dripping blood as he made his way up the stairs. Well, if you go to Rome today, you can not only visit these steps, but you too can also climb them, as thousands of pilgrims do every day, many on their knees. And as you do, you will see under glass or some protection, red-appearing droplets that are supposedly some of Christ's blood. You'll find these holy stairs just across the street from the Basilica of St. John Lateran, and the building housing the stairs was in the early 14th century the home of the popes, that is, until the popes had to take temporary residency in Avignon. The steps were known as the Scala Sancta, the Holy Stairs, and consists of 28 white marble steps that originally, as I said, led up to the palace of Pilate. Well, the immediate question is, how did the steps find their way to Rome all the way from Jerusalem? Good a question, but there is a rather simple explanation in which there is no miracle involved other than the miracle of faith, which I will explain. Back in the 300s, Constantine had become the emperor, and as such was undoubtedly one of the most powerful men in the world, and of course was the founder of Constantinople and reigned from 306 to 337. Perhaps most notably, though, he was the first Roman emperor to convert to Christianity, and he encouraged religious tolerance to members of all faiths. Well, due to his personal faith, he was responsible for the conversion of his mother Helena, who would become a virtual whirlwind of activities promoting the faith by building great churches throughout the empire, including Bethlehem and other places in the Holy Land. When she learned of the steps leading up to what was Pilate's palace, she had the steps removed and shipped to Rome. It's most common for pilgrims visiting the stairs to ascend them on their knees. Stairs have been built to the sides of the holy stairs to allow the pilgrims to descend back to the street level without disturbing those climbing the stairs, on their knees often reverently kissing the steps as they ascend. I've had the good fortune to visit those steps several times, and one has a feeling of great awe, experiencing that you are possibly moving in the same place that Jesus Christ walked just before being sentenced by Pilate to be crucified. Even so close to the center of the bustling city of Rome, there is certainly a sense of peace, tranquility, and spirituality to be found at the holy stairs as one literally walks in the footsteps of Christ. And as we speak about the events leading up to the crucifixion of Christ, another bit of history might be summed up in the question, whatever happened to the veil of Veronica? Oh, we've all heard the story of how the face of Jesus, undoubtedly sweating and with blood from the crown of thorns, was wiped with a cloth by Veronica. Well, that's not exactly correct, but not too far wrong. It wasn't Veronica. Her name was actually Seraphia. And as Jesus passed her, she was so moved by what she was seeing that she wiped his face in the hope it would make him feel better. And since he was condemned to death on the cross, he was considered a criminal, and criminals were to be avoided. However, she bravely ignored the political protocol of the day and rushed forward to courageously help him. In return for her bravery, an image of his face, as we remember, was left on the cloth as a special favor for her act of heroism in the face of one who was considered a criminal and sentenced to death. The cloth bearing the image of Jesus was referred to in Latin as vera icon, which translated means true image. Now, over the years, the two words, vera icon, were put together as part of the miraculous image became Veronica, instead of Seraphia, who was reportedly a woman of means, perhaps in her 50s, who may have stepped forward during the time in which Simon of Cyrene was taking the cross from Jesus, and the procession had temporarily stopped or slowed. As a side issue, there is a story that Tiberius Caesar was seriously ill in Rome and had summoned Veronica, as she was now known after hearing about the death and resurrection of Christ, and that looking at the cloth, he immediately regained his health. Well, as the story goes, Veronica was believed to have given the veil to Clement I, who was the third successor to St. Peter. Well, where is the veil of Veronica, and does it still exist? The answer is simple. Yes, it still exists, and is kept in a very special reliquary in St. Peter's Basilica, in a magnificent repository not too far from where the remains of St. Peter are located, where three keys to the locks of the vault are kept by the canons of St. Peter. Now, I'm going forward to another story that I'm sure all of us have. Well, we have several religious medals that represent saints, special devotions, and the like. But I think the most popular medal in all the world is the Miraculous Medal, or at least the medal that we know as the Miraculous Medal. We've talked about this before with particular emphasis on St. Catherine Labouré, but I want to include the relic connected to the Miraculous Medal. So let me give you just a short outline of this amazing story that started back on July 18th in 1830, the feast of St. Vincent de Paul, who, with St. Louise de Marillac, founded the Sisters of Charity. Sister Catherine Labouré was a postulant in the Order of the Sisters of Charity in Paris, which was located on the Rue de Bac, which translated means the back street. Catherine had always been a very religious girl, even from her childhood, and as she was growing up, she had her eyes on a religious vocation, even though her father was very much opposed to it. She had many chores, but always attended daily mass and even fasted twice a week. She was a popular girl. She received at least two proposals from young suitors, but rejected their offers, eventually becoming a novice. Her entire life, her every breath, her every action was focused on her vocation and her devotion to the Blessed Mother. Well, while she was still a novice, she had retired for the night as usual. And on this July evening, which just happened to be the feast of St. Vincent de Paul, the founder of the order, she'd not been asleep for long when she was awakened by a child that seemed to be about 5 years old, telling her to come quickly to the chapel because the Blessed Mother was coming to see her. Well, as one would expect, she got up from her bed and followed the child to the chapel. and as she opened the door to the chapel, she was amazed to see it so brightly lit, as though every light in the church was blazing. I'm sure she must have felt a great deal of trepidation and concern for the other nuns living there, that they might be disturbed. And then she heard the rustling of a dress as the Blessed Mother appeared and crossed to a chair in front of the altar, where she sat down and summoned Sister Catherine to her side. The chair was usually there reserved for the director of sisters. Well, of course, Catherine immediately knelt down out of respect, but the Blessed Mother told her to come to the foot of the altar where she was sitting, and Catherine was permitted to kneel and rest her hands on the knees of her heavenly visitor, who told her that great graces would be showered on her and all who would ask for them, whether they be rich or poor. When the apparition ended, Catherine returned to her room. And then later, then in November of the same year, Catherine was again in the chapel making her afternoon meditation. I would interject here that the chapel, as it has been described, is not a tiny little chapel, but the size of many churches. I've had the good fortune to have been there in the chapel at the Rue de Bac, and I would guess that it would hold as many as several hundred worshippers. Well, on this November day, she heard the rustling of the Madonna's dress, just as she had heard it before, and looking up, she saw the Mother of God standing near a picture of Saint Joseph. She was holding a small globe near her heart that slowly seemed to vanish. There were rings on her fingers that seemed to radiate rays of light as she held her hands out, symbolic of the many graces she would give to those who asked for them from her. Then she appeared to be standing in an oval frame, and around her there were brilliant letters which read, "O Mary, conceived without sin, pray for us who have recourse to thee." And then Catherine heard a voice saying, "Have a medal struck from this model. Persons who wear it will receive great graces, especially if they wear it around their neck. Graces will be bestowed abundantly upon those who have confidence." And then the vision seemed to be in reverse, that is, the other side of the medal, and there was an image of what might be called Our Lady's monogram, the image that we know from the back of the medal. Catherine was privileged for a third visit, which was very similar to the last. Well, as duty would require, Catherine reported this only to her superior and her spiritual director, and after careful evaluation, they both determined that she was telling the truth, but it would be several years before the medal would be struck as requested. Now, at that time when the medal was struck, there was a terrible plague that was taking the lives of many thousands in a single month in Paris. But those who were wearing this medal that was given to Catherine were surviving in such great numbers that the medal was to be referred to as the Miraculous Medal. And the name stuck. And incidentally, as I have mentioned, it is the most popular religious medal in the world today. Sister Catherine was given the responsibility of working in the hospice during the next 46 years with the other nuns, knowing that one of their own had been graced with a visit from the Virgin Mary, but they did not know who it was. Her duties during the remainder of her life was caring for the most repugnant and doing the most menial tasks possible. Catherine died on December 31st of 1876, after having said that she would never see 1877. 56 years after her death, her tomb was opened, prior to her beatification in March of 1933, and though her resting place was very damp, which should have resulted in her bodily disintegration, her body was perfectly preserved and was moved to a side altar in the mother house on the Rue de Bac, close to the altar where so many years before she had been privileged by a visit from the Mother of God. Her body rests beneath the side altar behind clear glass, where you can stand and gaze upon St. Catherine Laboureil. And incidentally, she looks as though she is just resting. And I was surprised how young I thought she looked despite her years. And the relic, besides the body of St. Catherine Laboureil, is the chair in which the Blessed Mother first sat, and it is placed exactly where it was that fateful night so many years ago. If you ever have a chance to visit Paris, don't miss the Rue de Bac. You will never forget your visit. As you can see, there are so many places with what we might call relics that we could talk for hours, but I've selected just a few of what I believe gives us a new insight to the many graces we've been given from above, and hopefully that can be used to strengthen our faith and follow the teachings of the Church. I was on a pilgrimage to Spain a number of years ago, and one of the sites that I was most anxious to visit was Zaragoza and the Shrine of Our Lady of the Pilar. But that was not to happen because our flight was so late and our schedule so full that several locations had to be missed, and this was one that had to be deleted in order to make it to Santiago de Compostela. Well, the story is that it appears that, according to legend, St. James the Greater, who was one of the original 12 apostles, had gone to Spain to evangelize this new Christian faith. Spain at that time was really just another pagan country. And arriving in that country, one can only imagine the enthusiasm that James must have had in his desire to evangelize this new faith. After all, he was a witness to the arrest, the crucifixion, and the resurrection of Christ, and was present in the upper room to be a witness to his having arisen from the dead. Well, he was bitterly disappointed with his attempts at evangelizing and converting the population. He had only attracted just a handful of followers, and I'm certain he must have felt that he was a failure, and not only to himself, but to Jesus Christ as well. This was a time in which the Blessed Mother was still in Jerusalem before John took her to Ephesus for safety, and was busy consoling the apostles and encouraging them in their efforts while making preparations prior to her departure with John. It was her wish, and to her, her responsibility, to see that these apostles would carry out the wishes of her son. It's widely believed that she knew that James would be the first disciple to shed his blood for the faith. And according to Matthew, Jesus said, I quote, "It is not necessary for my glory that the apostles labor and follow me to the cross and to the death that I have suffered for the whole human race. The first one to imitate me is my faithful servant James, who wished to return to Jerusalem, where he would face martyrdom." And he made known to his mother what he wished her to do, according to the legend. He made known to her that he desired her to go to Zaragoza and have James return to Jerusalem, where he would become the first apostle to be martyred. But first, he desired that James should found a church in Zaragoza. So one day, James was praying with a few of his followers or converts on the shores of the Ebro River when, as ordered by the Lord, a band of angels transported Mary, who was placed on a throne formed by a magnificent cloud, and was transported to Zaragoza, where she appeared in person, very possibly through bilocation. with the angels also carrying a small column, possibly hewn of marble, with a small image of herself. As James recognized Mary, he fell to his knees, and then she showed him her image on the pillar that was still in the hands of the angels, and while giving him her blessing, she said, "My son, James, this place, the Most High and Omnipotent God of Heaven has destined to be consecrated by thee upon earth for the erection of a church and house of prayer where under my patronage and name he wishes to be glorified and magnified, where the treasures of his right hand shall be opened up for all the faithful through my intercession, if they ask for them in true faith and sincere piety." Well, at the command of the Blessed Mother, the angel set up the column, and upon it the small sacred image of her that many believe still stands to this day, almost 2,000 years later, as the first church actually dedicated to the Blessed Virgin. The pillar is now a part of a larger basilica that is a site of both reported miracles and pilgrimages, and true to what Mary was told, James returned to Jerusalem, where he became the first martyred apostle. So visiting Our Lady in Pilar would certainly be visiting a relic. Now, we all have our favorites, and one of mine is that little stone house that stands near the top of a mountain in Ephesus. We know that in the years following the ascension of Jesus into heaven, there was a great persecution of Christians, and John, fearing for the safety of the Blessed Mother, took her to Ephesus, where there were many Christians, and where she could live in relative peace in a small stone house that he built on a mountain high overlooking Ephesus. And over the centuries since that move, there have been earthquakes and other natural disasters that have appeared to wipe out much of the city. However, in our time, Ephesus is still a big attraction for the ruins that are still standing and is a popular attraction as shore excursions for visiting ships docking for the day at Turkey's port of Kusadasi. But what about Mary's house? Well, to tell the story, we have to go back to the days of Blessed Anne Catherine Emmerich, who wrote about the life of Christ, from which Mel Gibson's acclaimed The Passion of the Christ was made. She received many visions, and from these visions she transferred them from pen to paper, and her descriptions of these times have been proven, to be so accurate that many scholars use her writings as reference to those particular times of the early days of the church and the life of Christ. But she also wrote in detail about the little stone house that John had built for Mary on the top of the mountain. She described the house in detail, telling where Mary slept, describing the little alcove where she kept her clothes, the small fire pit in one room over which meals were cooked, and even a small curve in the wall toward the back of the little house. And in addition, she described a spring outside the house from which she would gather water. Well, some of the scholars who read these particular descriptions found them hard to believe, particularly when referring to a small spring on the top of a mountain in an otherwise arid part of Turkey. We've done a broadcast about a sister of charity named Sister Marie Mandan de Grancey, who was a missionary and who was living in the early part of the dawn of the 20th century in Turkey, and had read Anne Catherine Emmerich's book and felt that it was necessary to find Mary's house. And so she was responsible for an expedition to follow Emmerich's directions up the mountain directly to the ruins of a small house, a small stone house on the top of the mountain that matched exactly how Emmerich had described it. And yes, there was a spring near the house where she could get water. Well, everything was exactly as Anne Catherine Emmerich had described it, as I mentioned, except the small curve in the back of the structure. Well, during the initial rehabilitation of the house a little later, some workmen were digging around the foundation toward the back and found that the original wall had a curve exactly as Anne Catherine Emmerich had written. Incidentally, Sister Marie Mandat de Grancey's cause for beatification has been introduced. But the story doesn't stop there. The good sister was responsible for finding this house of Mary, but over the years, more work was needed. Well, in the 20th century, there was a man named George Quatman from Lima, Ohio, who was a man of means. He was president of the local phone company, and more importantly, he held a patent for direct dial. It appears that he was on a vacation with his wife somewhere toward the middle of the 20th century, and they were visiting the antiquities of Ephesus. And as evening fell, looking up at the mountain, he beheld what he described as a vision of the Blessed Mother above the mountain on which her house was built and was in need of repair. He interpreted this as a request for him to do something about it, so he founded the American Society of Ephesus to help maintain and restore the little house of the Virgin Mary. The story of his vision, as well as his assistance, was known to Pope Pius XII. And if you are to visit Mary's house in Ephesus today, you will see plaques along the way giving credit to the American Society of Ephesus. I had the good fortune a number of years ago to meet and spend an afternoon with Mr. Quatton before I too had the opportunity of visiting Mary's house. And I can only tell you, as you looked inside to where she kept her clothes, where she slept, where she cooked, well, it provided a wonderful feeling of closeness being where she lived and where she died. Oh, if you go to Israel today, you will see a tomb that was supposed to be the grave of Mary, but there was no mention of her dying in Jerusalem until the 3rd century. Anne Catherine Emmerich maintained she died in Ephesus, and her empty grave, due to her assumption into heaven, will be discovered when the time is right. Both Blessed John Paul II and Pope Benedict XVI have visited and paid their respects to Mary's house. Pope Benedict recently offered Mass at the Holy House. And incidentally, Mary's house has been forensically studied by scientists, including, I believe, carbon dating. And Mary's little house on the top of the mountain dates back to the 1st century, and every detail is exactly as Anne Catherine Emmerich saw it. And today, it may be surprising to know that hundreds of thousands of pilgrims visit Mary's house every year, and the largest percentage of visitors are Muslim. Perhaps Mary, because Mary is the only woman mentioned in the Quran, and she's mentioned 34 times. Well, these are just a few of the many, many places that exist today to strengthen the faith and those connected to Mary. Well, after all, she is, in a way, the mother of us all, and just perhaps she is the one to bring us all together. This is Tom Shrewsbury with Reflections for the Covenant Network.